Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Will Sommer. Welcome to the Daily Beast's Fever Dreams. I'm a politics reporter at the Daily Beast, and I'm currently working on a book about QAnon called Trust the Plan for HarperCollins, coming out later this year.
And I'm Kelly Weil. I am also a reporter at the Daily Beast, and I'm the author of the book Off the Edge, Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything.
On this podcast, we're going to take you on plunges into the sometimes hilarious, sometimes scary fanatics infecting the way that millions of Americans view the world and how they vote.
Even in the aftermath of the Trump administration, the energy of these conspiracy theorists, grifters, and influencers is still pushing our mainstream political landscape closer and closer to a breaking point.
Okay, today on Fever Dreams, we have guest host and Daily Beast political reporter Zach Petrizzo. Zach, I hear there's some things going down in Congress. What's going on?
There sure are. This week, we've seen a lot of weird things going on. You know, we saw a guy chain himself to the Supreme Court. You know, a lot of weird things are happening in D.C., but something even weirder is happening in Marjorie Taylor Greene's office. She has enlisted a new intern. Milo is now an intern in her office. And, of course, this is the former Breitbart editor who, you know, is since kind of taken a hard fall from right-wing stardom, if you will. He used to make his way around college campuses across the country, and now he's, you know, reduced to being an intern walking around with a Louis Vuitton briefcase.
37-year-old intern. I believe they made a Robert De Niro movie about that.
It's interesting. I know when the Daily Beast had reached out to Marjorie Taylor Greene's office for comment, of course, I gave Milo a call. I didn't hear back from him. They basically confirmed it.
Right. So this is Milo Yiannopoulos. I mean, this is someone who, you know, us true Gamergate heads going back, you know, have known of his antics back since 2014 when he was this, you know, kind of this Gamergate figure. His claim to fame after that was, you know, I'm the Trump supporter, but I'm gay. You know, and so a lot of these kind of hard right guys were like, well, we don't, you know, hate gay people. We like Milo. We like his antics.
Right.
Essentially, this guy is like the ultimate kind of like attention hungry. Like he'll do anything for attention. He stoops to, you know, there's no level to which he won't stoop. But, you know, he was a relatively prominent figure. You know, he had this Breitbart position and then he kind of took a lot of lumps. And so one of them was, you know, I mean, he was at the point where he was going to be a big deal speaker at CPAC in 2017. And then this video emerged of him essentially defending pedophilia and saying, you know, well, if a priest, you know, has sex with a kid, maybe it's not so bad. That's kind of part of the whole shebang. And then when that video emerged, CPAC understandably was like, wait a minute, maybe this guy shouldn't be our star. And then, you know, he had this video that was going to be a big deal. And then ultimately, you know, it was one of the big five publishers was going to push it out and they backed off from it. So, and then he really kind of, I would say, finally got exiled when BuzzFeed did this big story about his ties with white supremacists. Essentially, he had a whole bevy of interns who had access to his email account, and one of them leaked it to BuzzFeed. And it was just all these, like, I mean, really fantastic story by Joe Bernstein even many years ago. But that was kind of the what we thought, at least, I think, would be the last of Milo hanging out with members of Congress. But that was before the era of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene being in Congress. And so Milo went down to Florida. He did this whole thing where he said, I'm not gay anymore. I'm an ex-gay guy. He had kind of a lot of little like stints in various things. He had a lot of feuds with various right-wingers. He had a lot of falling out. He claimed that he was going to make an anti-gay therapy place with all these like insinuations of like electroshock therapy. Needless to say, none of these things have come to fruition. But now he's on to his new thing, which is being an intern. And Zach, how did you originally, you know, sort of key onto this, that this was happening?
As you know, there's a fellow kind of right-winger named Lauren Witzke, who of course is this producer on Stu Peters' show. She kind of hangs out with Milo and is part of the fringe. And then also, of course, you have, you know, since Milo's fall from fame, he's kind of become he started hanging out with all these kind of white nationalist groypers. So that's kind of Nick Fuentes' group and those folks. He's been joking for a while that him and Lauren Witzke are getting married and all this stuff. And clearly there was kind of some back and forth on Telegram. So when they were on Telegram, they were kind of joking around about coming into DC and all this stuff. And that's when it started to really bubble up. And then, of course, on Monday, Milo posted to Telegram kind of a picture of this congressional badge, if you will, clearly showing that, you know, he was an intern. And then, of course, you know, the Daily Beast confirmed it. And Marjorie Taylor Greene herself confirmed that Milo's an intern now in her office.
Right. So this statement here is that she put out is responding to this idea that, you know, Milo is this extremely controversial figure who, among other things, has called for members of Congress to be hanged and has had an unusually laissez-faire attitude towards pedophilia. And so she says, "I have an intern that was raped by a priest as a young teen, was gay, has offended everyone at some point, turned his life back to Jesus and church, and changed his life." Great story. And so, great story, I want to be clear, is still in the quote from her. Great story. I guess what was your reaction when you got that statement from her office?
It confirms that he's an intern, of course. But yeah, no, it was a little bit weird, like the whole thing, because of course she's pretty, like, you know, she claims at one point she was pretty cozy with QAnon.
Yeah, she's like a hardcore QAnon believer, yeah.
Right, and the whole idea of QAnon, Will, you know, you're the expert, but long story short, it's that, you know, there's a group of Democratic politicians having kind of sex and there's a big cabal with children, right? So pedophilia is kind of pretty, you know, you would think that's pretty against her beliefs, and anyone who ever even, you know, was kind of anywhere near aligned with sympathizing for pedophilia would be kind of, you know, a person non grata. But of course, you know, I found it pretty weird that she would like openly embrace Milo, especially with some of those hardcore QAnon ties.
So, you know, putting aside what Milo's up to here, and I think it's fair to say he's up to getting attention and who knows, maybe berating members of Congress. I guess we'll see how that shakes out. What do you think Marjorie Taylor Greene's game is here?
Their office hasn't responded to inquiries about this, but I do think that he's behind a new podcast that Marjorie Taylor Greene's kind of putting out. Of course, on Telegram, he's been promoting this podcast that Marjorie Taylor Greene's putting out, and kind of anytime the podcast goes live, he's kind of like, you know, talking about it. So I think he is kind of behind some of the podcasting, and I do think that originates from kind of Matt Gaetz and other members of Congress, you know, who have kind of been alienated from places like Fox News, for example, you know, just not mainstream enough to go on Fox News, quite frankly, and they've kind of created their own like alternative media right-wing ecospheres, if you will, and I think Milo, you know, is kind of behind this whole thing with.
I think you're right on the money. I mean, I think if you watch this Marjorie Taylor Greene podcast / video production, MTG Live, it has Milovian touches, I think. And that was why, even before this was public, it sort of aesthetically, you know, as someone who's you know, followed Milo's aesthetic for many years, I had the suspicion that he was involved in this. Well, you know, look, I'm sure Milo will be taking on all the duties of a Capitol Hill intern. He'll be leading constituents on tours. He'll be getting dry cleaning and coffee, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, appreciate your reporting on this. I do think this is interesting because this puts him in an interesting spot as a provocateur. Theoretically, I mean, obviously this gives him access to the halls of Congress. I think, are we going to see him, you know, yelling at, you know, Jamie Raskin, at AOC? Certainly, I think his fellow traveler, Laura Loomer, whose whole bid for Congress is premised on the idea that she'll yell at other members of Congress if you elect her. She must be like, oh, shoot, you know, this guy beat me to it. Oh, I should have been an intern. So this is, you know, look, I think it's interesting to watch. It's really not great for, I think, the Congress as an institution. But, you know, I think it adds another volatile element, even by Marjorie Taylor Greene's standards, into her office. And one has to wonder, you know, how the rest of the GOP is going to feel about that.
I think it's an interesting question, too, for Kevin McCarthy to have to answer to as well. I will note, though, that this intern kind of maneuver here, if you will, this intern enlisting of, you know, kind of these controversial figures, you know, was kind of first kind of brainstormed by Matt Gaetz, of course, when he, you know, last year had kind of proposed that Kyle Rittenhouse become an intern.
This is such a funny tactic.
Yeah, like why don't we have Sean Hannity as like Lauren Boebert's intern, right? Like,
well, it's kind of the follow-up of the idea we talked about recently, where it's like the Speaker of the House doesn't have to be, you know, a member of Congress. Let's make Mark Levin or someone like that. Let's make Steve Bannon the Speaker of the House. You know, perhaps we now can have these stunt internships.
Yeah, it's truly wild. I do think I'd be very curious to hear the stories of Milo as an intern. Perhaps he'll grab coffee with me one day on the Capitol Hill.
Great.
So, Will, this week we saw news break that the Proud Boys now face another hurdle as January 6th prosecutions push forward and more documents in regards to the Capitol riots are kind of shown to the public. What's new with the Proud Boys?
Sure. So this week, the big news, you know, speaking of Congress, the big news on Thursday is going to be the January 6th committee's first hearing. Is it going to be damning information? Is it going to be a snooze? Even if it is damning information, will anyone care? I think that all remains to be seen. But the big news earlier this week is that we have fresh indictments against top leadership in the Proud Boys, the far-right men's drinking fraternity slash allegedly seditious organization that, you know, played a key role, I think it's fair to say, in the brawling of the Capitol riots, whose members did. I was thinking about this when these indictments came down, and these indictments were published on Monday, and they charged people like Proud Boys leader slash sometimes federal informant Enrique, or to his detractors, Fedrique.
Really? They call him that, Will?
They do. They do. Wow. It's funny. Yeah. I mean, the whole January 6th thing has kind of created a lot of disagreements within the Proud Boys. And so there's kind of a lot of factions now. But anyways, so Fedrique has been charged, as has Joe Biggs, who is kind of one of these kind of big brawler guys and one of these kind of the face of the most militaristic elements of the Proud Boys. A guy named Ethan Nordian, a.k.a. Rufio Panman, taking his alias from the 90s movie Hook.
Wow.
And a couple other characters. So they've been charged with seditious conspiracy, which, you know, is a pretty serious charge here from my perspective. But I was thinking about this, you know, back when, I think 2017, I wrote my first article about the Proud Boys. This was an organization known at the time. They had a lot of YouTube videos. They were known for obviously being founded by Gavin McGinnis of, you know, one time of Vice magazine. They had rules about, you know, if you joined, they would punch you and you had to name five cereals in a sort of beating in. They had a rule since abandoned that you couldn't wear flip-flops. You know, they had obviously restrictions on how much members could pleasure themselves in a given month. And I will say, writing about this, and I thought, pretty weird bunch. I never thought they would try to bring down our government. And that just shows how things could change, you know? I think some of this information has come out in the past, but I thought it was interesting reading this indictment because it really shows how the Proud Boys have changed over time. So, you know, let's think back, you know, like I said, I mean, I was talking about back in the day when they would record music videos about how you can't wear flip-flops. And then in the aftermath of the election in November 2020, the Proud Boys showed up in D.C. a couple times. They had some brawls with Antifa, and it kind of seems like the Proud Boys came off the worse for wear. One of their members got stabbed. In the aftermath of these sort of initial forays in the lead up to January 6th, the indictment reveals Joe Biggs, who is this former InfoWars personality who turned into kind of a big Proud Boys burly boy. He's complaining because Gavin McGinnis, when he created the Proud Boys, which again are named after a long since forgotten song in the Aladdin musical, he had created them ostensibly as a drinking club. There was something of this kind of paramilitary element to it, but I don't think that was really like front and center. So Biggs is complaining in a message to Enrique Terrio. He's saying basically, like, you know, we quote recruit losers who want to drink. So this was really billed as like the modern day Elks Club. And Biggs is like, this stinks. We got a bunch of fat losers. They can't fight. They're getting beaten up by Antifa. And then he says, let's get radical and get real men. And that's kind of like, way to go, because they then start this organization within the Proud Boys called the Ministry of Defense, according to the indictment. And they start really recruiting like the most hardcore members of the Proud Boys, guys who have gained prominence within the group for their brawls in Portland and other places with left-wing protesters. So these are the guys who kind of make up your hardcore element of the Proud Boys. Now, on January 6th, this group then rallies in front of the Capitol. They specifically do not wear their Proud Boys yellow and black. The other thing, you know, this comes up a lot with right-wing personalities, is how much they have to announce their stuff online before they do it. And so Joe Biggs is like, okay, everyone, we're coming incognito. We're not wearing our yellow and black. I mean, I knew about that and stuff. And so certainly it seems as though the feds noticed that as well. They show up. I noticed them and they were, you know, and I was taking pictures of them, videos, and they were chanting things like time to attack the Capitol.
Oh, wow.
And people would say, hey, like, don't reveal our plan. As it turned out, you know, at least some of those people then did that. The indictment also reveals, I think, some interesting plotting with Enrique Terrio, who was banned from D.C. at the time of the riot because he was picked up on a weapons charge. He's saying, you know, after the riot, he's texting with another member who I believe himself had been stabbed and so was also sitting out the riot. And so he's saying, you know, dude, did we just influence history? And Terrio, who I think is a little smarter, there's a reason he runs the gang, he says, let's first see how this plays out. And then the stabbed guy says, they have to certify today, or it's invalid. The implication being that, you know, I guess there's not going to be a president anymore or something, because the boys had successfully delayed the certification of the results. So, Zach, what are your thoughts here?
Wow, that seems like pretty good proof for alleged sedition, if you will. So where do you think this all leads, Will? Do you think that there's potential outcome here at all? Do you think there's more to be released?
Yes. Yeah, so I think one interesting thing that's happening here is that there's a high-ranking Proud Boy who is cooperating with the feds, a guy named Charles Donahue. And so the people who are indicted in this are kind of the, for folks who have followed January 6th at all, like these cases, these are kind of like your marquee Proud Boys. So like I said, you've got Rufio Panman, you've got Federica.
I love, Will, how you know them all by their nicknames, too. It's a nice touch. Right?
They're nom de guerre. Yeah. I mean, it's a weird scene. And, you know, I mean, in many ways, I think looking back on it, you know, if you look at like the summer of 2020, 2019, when every summer a couple Proud Boys would emerge from their local Proud Boy scenes for their fighting prowess. And then you look back on it and say, I wonder if this system is promoting violence. You know, they have a degree, the fourth degree membership in the Proud Boys is for getting arrested for committing violence in the name of the club, although they later changed that to self-defense, you know, wink, wink. In a way, this sort of funneled them all towards January 6th, in a way that they selected then the most violent members. I can't really speak to the legal case about it. It certainly seems like, based on the indictments, that they have a ton of evidence on it. But and especially now that you have this Donahue guy who is cooperating with the feds, I would say it's not looking good for the Proud Boys leadership. I mean, once you start talking about sedition, you're talking about like serious, heavy years and years and years of punishment in prison. So I think this is kind of an amuse-bouche ahead of the January 6th committee, any revelations that come out of that on Thursday. This is the special congressional episode. We're talking a lot about Congress this week. Zach, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House apparent, should Republicans win back the House in the midterms, but he's getting roasted by Trump supporters. What's going on?
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, kind of in charge of all the craziness that happens over on the House side when it comes to Republicans and trying to keep people in line, now has problems, you know, for himself. Of course, he's been wanting the endorsement of Trump. I think everyone in the Republican Party, to a certain extent, more or less, wants Trump's backing as it helps them get through kind of primaries in which they might be outflanked to the right. And of course, this is no different for Leader Kevin McCarthy, who in California, as of yesterday, when this podcast episode airs, will have, you know, completed his primary race in California. And he wanted the endorsement of Trump because at the end of the day, many of, you know, his own voters are pretty hardcore Trump supporters. And he wants to appeal to that side of the party. But now, after his weekend endorsement from Trump put out on Truth Social, you know, he now faces backlash, as we reported over at the Daily Beast.
He got the Truth Social truth of approval.
Yeah, over on Truth, of course, we had one supporter and Will, I went through all these truthers, or I guess what do you call them? They send out what, truths, and they retruth.
It is kind of funny to call members of Truth Social truthers, because I mean, because it's certainly true, right? I mean, it's an accurate description.
Yeah, but these guys in the Truth, I don't know what you call the comment. Do you call it a comment section on Truth? I don't know.
The Truth Zone.
The Truth Zone. I love it. So these Trump supporters were kind of in Trump's mentions and were just blowing Trump up. I mean, like one guy wrote, what the heck, all upset. And his bio stated that he's going to vote for Trump a quote unquote third time. Another guy wrote, you know, another person with like a gun as a profile picture wrote, the guy, referring to McCarthy, talks behind your back. Yuck. So, I mean, of course, many of Trump's own supporters were pretty upset. And of course, you had kind of more of the MAGA hardcore base, people like Laura Loomer, as we spoke about earlier. You know, she wrote something along the line of, he isn't even loyal to the Trump base, really upset, right? Roger Stone, of course, a longtime kind of like informal confidant of Trump, wrote that, you know, he thinks that McCarthy should be impeached and kind of like tossed out of the House. And he's not, you know, pro-Trump enough. Of course, we had Fox News contributor Leo Terrell, right? Kevin McCarthy does not want President Trump to win re-election in 2024, right?
So what's going on here? Why are these guys so mad at Kevin McCarthy?
They see Kevin McCarthy as kind of a squish, right? So kind of a rhino, of course, as we talked about last week on the pod, kind of a rhino who isn't Trumpian enough. And especially after the New York Times leaked those audio tapes of Kevin McCarthy kind of mulling the idea of trying to push Trump to resign after January 6th, a lot of his most hardcore supporters, of course, view January 6th, you know, in a very different way than I think many folks perhaps on Capitol Hill do, as kind of this attack on democracy. Many of, you know, Trump's own supporters and McCarthy's own supporters have turned on him, don't see it that way. So I do think there's kind of this growing faction where Trump supporters are kind of turning on McCarthy more and more. You see like this burgeoning gap. Of course, there was a right-wing writer on Twitter that, you know, kind of tied Kevin McCarthy to his quote-unquote bunk buddy, Frank Luntz, right? So they see McCarthy as this establishment character.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but McCarthy rents an apartment from Luntz, is that right? Correct?
Yeah, yeah. So they've kind of been longtime friends that seemingly have not only been friends, but also been kind of like professional co-workers to a certain extent. Their minglings are very much intertwined when it comes to work. I know, of course, on January 6th, Frank Luntz was, you know, kind of tweeting from Kevin McCarthy's limousine. So they have this very entangled...
that's the true bro lifestyle there.
Like, yeah.
Okay.
They have a very entangled relationship. Of course, McCarthy claims after kind of like Tucker Carlson kind of ripped into him that, you know, he was only like renting and the renting, you know, stopped at one point, but they've always been like kind of really, really close friends. I know, you know, some of my reporting where I used to work at salon.com, you know, we had tied Kevin McCarthy to, you know, he appeared, you know, for clients of Luntz at like focus groups. And it was just, they had a very, very close relationship.
Okay. So they have all these connections. These guys don't like Frank Luntz because he's not, you know, as crazy pro-Trump as they would like. So, you know, it is interesting. These hardcore grassroots types, they maybe it is the nature of congressional leadership on the right, but they always hate the guys who are, you know, steering the ship, right? Or, you know, at least I think they have as long as I can remember. I mean, these guys, they despise Mitch McConnell, even though he's the guy who gets everything done for them. Mm-hmm. You know, they hate Kevin McCarthy, although... I mean, I think he's a little less effective than Mitch McConnell. So let's say they win back the House, as it certainly appears to will happen. I mean, is Kevin McCarthy going to be, you know, is he going to be out? Is he not going to take the Speaker's gavel?
You know, I still think he does take the Speaker's gavel. I think he has a lot of power kind of among these Washington, D.C. corridor insiders that really do control parts of the Republican Party still. I know that, you know, people within kind of McCarthy land don't view, you know, the idea of Trump being put up as Speaker as a real threat. But, you know, there is still a lot of, you know, energy there from the MAGA base saying, look, this needs to be done. We need somebody more hardcore. We need somebody who will just start millions of investigations kind of on Democrats.
Who would these guys, who would they like to see become Speaker?
Well, I think they would love to, you know, Trump become Speaker is kind of their number one right now. I think they could put up anyone, though.
We love Trump, you know?
Yeah. I will note there are also members of Congress pushing this, right? Of course, Matt Gaetz, you know, had suggested that Jim Jordan should be put up for Speaker, and he said he's a real hard worker, right? So there are calls from within the House, no pun intended, too, for a new Speaker who's more hardcore. And you could see someone from the Freedom Caucus kind of give Kevin McCarthy a run for his money.
Make a play for it. I feel like these bids to like oust the main guy, you know, I feel like it never really comes to fruition, but maybe it will this time. It's certainly interesting to watch. I think should Republicans win back control of the midterms, and particularly if a Republican wins back the White House in 2024, I think we're headed for, you know, I think it's sort of easy to stay united when you're out of power. And I think what you're pointing out here with the Kevin McCarthy stuff is I think that there is kind of a new era of much more wide open factionalism on the right that awaits us.
Absolutely. And you also see these folks kind of turn up on the right here that might be in it for a headline or two. But at the same time, I do think the people like, for example, Matt Gaetz really do want to see a new Speaker in there. And we could potentially find this kind of among those ranks.
Interesting stuff, Zach, as always.
This week on Fever Dreams, we are joined by who, Will?
We're joined by documentary filmmaker Brian Knappenberger. This is a guy who's made documentaries. A lot of his documentaries are kind of about the internet and unsavory or noble characters, like internet activist Aaron Swartz and the hackers behind Anonymous. And now he has the new Netflix Netflix docuseries Web of Make Believe, with the great subtitle Death Lies in the Internet. This is, you know, it focuses on lots of unsavory characters, including myself, and Fever Dreams podcast temporarily departed co-host Kelly Weil. So Kelly and I are both in the episode about the Seth Rich conspiracy theories.
Wow.
But, you know, I was watching some screeners for this. It comes out on June 15th on Netflix, and he's got everything from online white supremacists to people who swat their online gaming rivals. So I think that Kelly did a great job in it. I kind of pop up a couple times as well. Brian has been studying these issues with the internet and what it's doing to our brains, and I think he's got a lot of great stories about it. So I think it should be a good interview.
Sounds like I might have to buy a Netflix account.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fever Dreams, like all Daily Beast journalism, exists because of the generous support of our subscribers, the people who pay for access to Daily Beast reporting and who are, quite frankly, our favorite people on the face of the planet.
Want to get in on all the action? Join now and get unlimited access to Beast reporting, exclusive ad-free newsletters, and our undying appreciation.
Head to feverdreams.thedailybeast.com to sign up.
Okay, today on Fever Dreams, we're joined by Brian Knappenberger. He's a documentary filmmaker. His latest docuseries is called Web of Make-Believe, Death Lies in the Internet. It's coming out on June 15th on Netflix, and I'm in one of the episodes about the Seth Rich conspiracy theory, along with our other Fever Dreams co-host, Kelly Weil. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Thanks for being in the series, too. Your interview was great.
Absolutely. I was happy to do it. I just watched the episode last night. I thought it was great how it turned out. So, Brian, you know, you're covering a lot of ground in this series. It covers everything from swatting, which is, you know, having people go to your enemies' houses or tricking the police into sending a SWAT team to someone's house, to, you know, various kind of internet blackmail, sex crimes, to the Seth Rich conspiracy theory. What do you think all these things have in common, and how did you get onto this theme?
Well, the premise is that we live in this world of chaotic disinformation, make-believe, where we don't quite understand, you know, what's real and what isn't. And that stuff kind of plays out in all sorts of different ways and reverberates through our society in all sorts of different ways and has these sort of direct effects on people. So rather than kind of, you know, hitting each of those subjects directly or doing it in a kind of academic way, we're really looking at it through, you know, characters, basically, and people and stories and sort of, you know, the way that kind of chaotic misinformation or technological networks and other sorts of things in our lives have real world reverberations.
I mean, it's certainly not something I try to do in my reporting as well. I mean, I think it really resonates with people when you take it out of the drama around an online game, perhaps as in the swatting episode or the sort of the entrails of 4chan as in the Seth Rich case. I mean, you know, in one of these, literally, I mean, it, you know, it's the internet reaching out and sending a SWAT team to your door. So how did you get, I mean, you know, obviously, I think the biggest one here for us on Fever Dreams is the Seth Rich case. You know, this is the case of the this Democratic National Committee staffer who's murdered, and then basically the right seizes on this murder, which appears to be a botched robbery, to turn it into this idea that Hillary Clinton had him murdered, or to cover up the Russian hack of Democratic emails. How did you get interested in that case? And you know, I mean, you really got lots of access to I think really many of the main players. Tell me about that.
Well, it's such a fascinating case. I mean, it really is. And you know this because I think you were following it right from its early days, you know, when it kind of first hit in the news and when it was kind of starting to show up on Reddit and things like that. You know, this story is this sort of, I mean, it's just such a fascinating kind of mix of things that sort of preyed on that moment so kind of perfectly. I mean, it was for almost kind of purely political reasons, these sort of, you know, sideline operatives really wanted this story to be true. you know, it was too good. It was too sort of convenient. So kind of in line with their own motives. And it seemed to kind of offer this promise of power for them or access. And so it was this really interesting mix of elements that, you know, took advantage of a kind of social media environment already primed for these sorts of things, the sort of conspiracy. And in this kind of already fact-check-free environment that was leading up to the election, you know, just diving into this, the way that this story unfolded, the way people kind of used it was really, really fascinating. And of course, at the heart of it is a family that's just trying to figure out what happened to their son and trying to get actual real information about their son who was murdered. So there's just so many elements of it that were so compelling that was just kind of central to kind of what we want to do with the series.
So you met Jack Berkman, I imagine, in your travels, yeah. I guess, through this whole ordeal. And I guess my first kind of more lighthearted question is, did you meet Jackie Jr.? And then more broadly, what was it that you kind of picked up and kind of really, you know, you kind of learned through it all with Jack and his role in this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, Jack Berkman, we did not meet Jackie Jr. The baby, as he calls it.
This would be his pet dachshund.
Yes. His pet dachshund.
The baby, Jackie Jr.
Yeah, right. That Milo threatened to kill, of course, just for a little more context.
Right. There's a lot of
layers.
a lot of very subtle layers to this. Yes. But no, in the piece, we met with Jack Berkman. I asked him a bunch of questions and we, of course, did hear about this, about what happened. He had been kind of conversing with this, what he thought was a source online. I didn't know who it was, but it turned out to be a kind of, you know, a relationship that had gone bad with a researcher that he had been working with. And when he went to go pick up some of these documents that presumably this person was leaving, the secret documents, there's this shootout and he goes through the whole thing and just the whole kind of beat by play about how, you know, he had to kind of, you know, escape this gunfire and a bullet hit Jackie Jr. in the paw. He had to throw the baby down, had to save the baby. Sounds true. He just kind of barely lived through this attempt to kill him.
It's always interesting to me when these sort of conspiracy theories and these people who really hype themselves up as kind of like operators then suddenly collide with, you know, often with one another in a real crime way. I've done work on like QAnon kidnappers, for example. The Jack Berkman one is funny because, I mean, this is a guy who really inserted himself into the Seth Rich case from the beginning, seeming like a somewhat quasi-respectable figure initially and then sort of just got kind of crazier and crazier.
Yeah.
I believe maybe it was Zach when Zach first talked to him once or someone else. And they said to me, they said, Andy said he was shot. They just assume it's a lie like everything else he says. But, you know, in this case, as you get into in the docuseries, it's all too real.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. He had shot in the butt twice, I think.
Yes,
we shouldn't laugh about that, but there is something great. I mean, you know, when Berkman first comes in, you know, we play some of those early press conferences. You know, he basically says there exists no theory of the case. Right. And a reporter yells out, well, what about a robbery? And he just kind of dismisses this. And, you know, it's pretty clear early on that this was a theory that they had. This was a juicy story that was in desperate search for some sort of proof. Right. And so really, for those reasons, it was just too good. It was too good not to keep kind of pursuing it. So any detail, no matter how insignificant, was treated as gold as long as it was, you know, some sort of breadcrumb along the way to giving the story more credibility. And, you know, it's just interesting in, you know, one of the overall effects, I think, of making a documentary like this, you know, stringing it out detail by detail, is just how flimsy each turn and each argument is when you kind of drag it out into the cold light of day. You know, it's like, you know, stepping stones in a river or something that crumble and, you know, disappear after you step on them. I mean, you look back, there's so little of real substance. I mean, I'm actually curious what Will thinks, but, you know, when you really kind of string it out in this way, it's kind of like there's not many anything solid that you can grab onto at any point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really had started the, you know, as you mentioned, you know, I started covering the Seth Rich stuff back in 2016, and when it was sort of just another sort of tragic local murder. And I guess I gave the hucksters involved with it maybe a lot more credibility for a lot longer than they deserved. I mean, I remember, I'm sure you've had this experience with Jack Berkman. I mean, this guy's a lobbyist, so he's kind of a smooth operator, or aspires to be, and, you know, is always very, wow, what a great question. You're a really great, you know, enterprising young reporter and all this. And then you talk to every other reporter who talks to him, and, you know, he's said the same to them. You know, I was like, well, maybe this guy's onto something. Maybe, you know, he seems at least earnest, if a little odd. And then, you know, cut to a year later, he has a press conference where he says, well, we have a DEA whistleblower who said he ran a hit team, you know, and all this. And, you know, all these conspiracy theorists show up along with me at this Holiday Inn where he ran his operations. And, you know, I just suddenly, oh, the whistleblower's not coming out. He's scared. He's on a video. He's going to conference call in. And even people who are working for like Jerome Corsi, all these conspiracy theorists, they're saying, boo, like this stinks, you know. And so actually, you know, on that note, this story, I imagine, Brian, this also interested you because, I mean, it draws in so many, I think, kind of flavors of right-wing operator in our modern media environment. You know, and the one who I think becomes a huge player in it is Ed Batowski, who then brings in Fox News. You know, talk to me about how that kind of collision between Batowski and Fox creates, it sort of takes the Seth Rich story to the next level. It takes it from Reddit accounts and people on 4chan and maybe some people on Twitter into really a sort of massive story.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. There's a couple figures like that. Butowski, first it's Assange, really, right? I mean, Assange kind of gives this aura of credibility to it. You know, Cy Hirsch is in the mix too. Yeah, but it gets to Butowski. He is on Fox News, is definitely a kind of solid mainstream kind of venue for this. By the time it gets there, it's really being taken seriously by a lot of people. And he's such a fascinating figure. We tried to interview him, by the way. We had a very weird Zoom conversation with him early on, and we thought he was going to talk to us. So much so that we actually flew down to Plano, Texas. We set up an interview, a whole big crew and everything, and lit it and everything else. And instead of Ed Butowski walking in the door, Ty Clevenger, his lawyer, walks in the door and sits in the interview. And so we actually really wanted to kind of get Butowski's perspective in this. We had to kind of use Ty as, we decided to interview Ty and use him as a kind of stand-in and try to understand where Butowski was coming from.
And so to set it up for people, I mean, Ed Butowski is this kind of occasional Fox News guest who then pays for this private investigator who has his own kind of self-aggrandizing reasons to get involved. And then ultimately this gets spun up on Sean Hannity as like this big FBI investigation into whether Seth Rich was involved in WikiLeaks and whether he was murdered for this reason. I mean, at the center of this is Seth Rich's grieving family. I think your series really kind of keeps going back to these human characters. And, you know, on one hand, I mean, there's kind of this like huge hubbub around, you know, whether it's Jack Berkman getting shot by a rival Seth Rich investigator or, you know, Ed Batowski having a falling out with his private investigator. I mean, as all this is happening, what is this doing to Seth Rich's parents?
Oh, I think you just nailed it. It's exactly what we were trying to kind of point out. I mean, as this theory kind of spins out in all of these different ways with all of these different figures for all of these kind of each with their own motive, you know, there's a family at the heart of it. Their son was murdered and they're trying to figure out what happened, trying to get real information in this world of chaotic misinformation and spin. And it's really tragic because every time you sort of, you know, cut back to them, you know, it's a portrait of a family who's trying to grieve and trying to follow every lead they can, as any family would, but time is ticking away and they're getting farther and farther away from an actual real answer about what happened to their son. So yeah, it has this absurdist kind of chronology in terms of when you follow the information or the story, kind of conspiratorial part of the story. When you go back to this grieving family, you really realize the kind of real world reverberation of what they were doing and what was happening, what was actually happening here.
Ed was, of course, on Fox News. What role did you see, you know, Fox kind of having in this whole thing? And even more so, have you seen them pull back? You know, they moved to dismiss lawsuits and settle on much of this. Do you think that they've kind of paid the right price for pumping this kind of into the mainstream?
It's hard to say they've paid the right price. They made a settlement with the Riches. We don't know 100%. I don't know if that's 100% public what that is. But they also made a deal right before some of their biggest stars were about to testify in this case. They struck a deal. And they also struck a deal to have the settlement kind of delayed, I believe, until after the election, the last election. So it was all kind of very secretive. I don't think it got a lot of publicity necessarily. There was a payout for the riches, but yeah, no, I don't think there's been a kind of reckoning, you know, for the mainstream big megaphone that Fox has for the kind of misinformation that they pumped out there.
And in terms of remorse from people like Jack Berkman and your adventures, did he kind of see any remorse there, or was it more of the same?
No, I don't see any remorse from them. I don't get any sense of that. From Ed Butowski and Ty Clevenger, I mean, it's kind of an interesting, I mean, they still are, I think, very much focused on this idea of Seth's laptop. You know, I mean, so this is the, you know, when the FBI is investigating Seth's murder, they get the laptop, and, you know, as they do in these sorts of things, they make an exact replica of this. So, and that has not been made public, the contents of that laptop. So, you know, their position really still is that there could be information on that laptop that shows that Seth was in contact with WikiLeaks or had something to do with the DNC hack. They think there's maybe something on there that explains this, and that Seth Rich had something to do with the leaks. And of course, that would then open the door to the second part of the story, that somehow his murder was related to his stealing and then supposedly leaking the emails. But I mean, you know, that seems pretty far-fetched, I think. I mean, you guys are reporters. I'm sure Will has filed his fair share of FOIA requests. I mean, it's the secrecy by itself, or the lack of transparency on the laptop, is not by itself any proof of anything. Obviously, they make a lot out of this, but as for someone who's filed a lot of FOIA requests, that kind of secrecy is basically called Tuesday. That's what they still, I think, believe. I think it's fair to say that they think there may be something on that laptop that proves this story still.
So, you know, it's interesting you bring up open records. Brian, I first became aware that you were working on this series because I saw your filings in a lawsuit Seth Rich's brother had filed against Ed Butowski, and the lawsuit had been settled, and you were hoping that we could get some more of the records. And, you know, this kind of dovetails with my personal belief, which is that every courtroom, at least one of interest, where there should be like a third lawyer representing the public and the media who's saying, like, yeah, come on, Your Honor, you know, open it up. Come on, we want to see it.
Definitely.
As you wrapped up this episode about Seth Rich, I mean, what were your unanswered questions? You know, what was still out there for you about how this conspiracy theory was manufactured? What do you wish you could have found out?
Well, there's still a lot to be understood about some of Butowski's involvement, and what they did is still interesting to me. You know, I was curious about, I tried to talk to Cy Hirsch, by the way, about we play the kind of surreptitiously recorded version of what, you know, Cy trying to kind of get information out of Ed Butowski. We play that in the piece. I wanted to sort of hear more from Cy. You know, the real answer to like what happened here is, you know, would be nice to know more about the details of what happened to Seth. You know, we don't have any of that information. And unfortunately, I think that's just the nature of this, that we don't actually have concrete information about what happened to him.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I was really closely watching your court motions. I was hoping, you know, we were going to get all kinds of files out.
We tried. We got turned down, unfortunately, yeah.
I know. You gave it your best shot. We have these other episodes in the series. You know, as I mentioned, there's one about swatting. What's that case? I mean, that's one that I was watching as well, where you have this young man who becomes kind of a professional swatter. You know, if you could tell us about that and what, in, you know, obviously, I think the Seth Rich case illustrates something about how the internet works in our real lives now. And what does the swatting case tell us?
It's such a fascinating case to me because this is the first time, you know, that we really know of that swatting actually caused a death, a real life death. It was something that investigators and, you know, police and people that were watching it had suspected might happen at some point. But I was just really curious to see how this had gone down. So we actually reached out. We managed to talk to Tyler Barris, the person you just mentioned, who had sort of become this notorious swatter. And I did an interview with him just in prison, just a recorded interview. That's kind of where it came from. We worked with another reporter, Brendan Koner, as well on this. But it is an absolutely fascinating kind of phenomenon that has been enabled by the internet, by the anonymity of some online platforms. So I just thought the story was really, really fascinating, the way that it kind of amplified, you know, it's this, should I tell a little bit about what the story is? It's
yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, so basically it starts with this online, it's, you know, people playing, two figures playing Call of Duty online, and there's a dispute happens. One of them kills the other one in the game, and they're on the same team. It's a friendly fire incident, and this escalates to some ridiculous level. They had sacrificed $1.50 bet, so they had put $1.50 down, a wager down on this game, and because of this, they had lost this, because of this friendly fire incident in the game, they had lost the bet. And so this becomes, you know, this kind of back and forth when you look at the text messages that eventually one of those players calls this notorious swatter, Tyler Barris, and Tyler, who goes under the handle, Twitter handle, Swatistic. I guess he makes money swats for people. People would pay him, you know, $20 or $50 in order to SWAT somebody, to call in a SWAT team on somebody's house. And he had kind of perfected these little scripts on how to do that. And I don't think he's making a lot of money. I think he also really kind of loved the notoriety that it brought him. And so he calls in this SWAT team to this house in Wichita, Kansas, that was almost in a taunting way given by one of the game players in the Call of Duty game. And he calls in the SWAT team. The SWAT team comes to the house, and one of the figures, this man, Andrew Finch, comes out of the house. The story is that Andrew makes some sort of a motion to his belt or tries to pull up his pants or something. And one of the SWAT team members sees this as threatening and shoots him and kills him. And it turns out that this was a fake address that was given to Tyler Barris. And the people, Andrew Finch and the Finch family and everybody that was inside the house at the time, really had no clue what was going on or why they were being surrounded by SWAT members. So we unpack this whole thing and what that means. It also becomes a kind of story about police overreaction and incompetence in some ways, because they are unable to kind of de-escalate the situation or understand what's happening. And the information the police were given is a lot different than what they encountered when they got to the house. So we kind of unpack each of these things and again find ourselves, you know, looking at the Finch family, which is experiencing the kind of effects of this, all of these actions that have started with an online game.
Well, it's a very interesting series and a sobering one, and it really showed me a lot of aspects of the internet in our lives I think that I hadn't considered. A lot of interesting cases. Again, that's Brian Knappenberger. His new Netflix series coming out June 15th is called Web of Make-Believe, Death, Lies, and the Internet. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Brian, thanks for coming by.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to this week's episode of Fresh Hell, where we unpack the weird and the wild on the internet and what you're going to see potentially your uncle talk about in 3 months.
Absolutely, Zach. Thank you. So this week on Fresh Hell, I've got a story I recently wrote for the Daily Beast about the world of true crime podcasting. Now, I will say this. I spend my life dealing with some in the right-wing demimonde, right? And I encounter some interesting characters, some people folks might not want to spend time with outside of work. That said, my recent foray into the world of true crime made me long for the days of QAnon and the Proud Boys, because wow, this is a weird community indeed. I think a lot of people, maybe, I guess from my perspective, I thought of true crime podcasting as like Serial, right? But then in terms of gloss and prestige, this goes down a little bit to like something I might listen to, where like the guy who wrote Bosch does a true crime podcast. And then way, way, way down is what I had to deal with last week. So there's a popular true crime podcast called The Prosecutors, and this stars two anonymous prosecutors named Brett and Alice, who, you know, they use their wisdom as true crime prosecutors to explain popular cases like the JonBenet Ramsey murder, for example. So these guys have been at it since 2020, and they become really popular.
Among what crowd?
Among true crime fans.
Oh, I missed it.
Like I said, I mean, this is kind of a world you and I think don't have a ton of interaction with, but I mean, true crime podcasting is enormous. These guys are roughly the 100th most popular true crime podcast, which I'm assured by podcast experts is actually like a hugely popular to have that rank. So my article is about fans of this podcast who started wondering, well, who are Brett and Alice? You know, they talk a lot about their legal experience and being podcasters, but they don't reveal their names. They don't reveal their faces. And when they started Googling them, they discovered that Brett and Alice are in fact Brett Talley and Alice LaCour, who are very high ranking members of the Republican, perhaps I shouldn't say high rank. Well, I guess one of them was nominated likely to be a federal judge. So they are very well placed members of the Republican legal elite, you know, the Federalist Society folks devoted to overturning abortion rights and expanding gun access, all that kind of stuff. In the case of Brett Talley in particular, these listeners discovered this guy is a sort of he was a failed Trump judicial nominee who was so unqualified, according to the American Bar Association, that he caused sort of a mini scandal in the early days of the Trump administration because people couldn't believe how unqualified he was. At the time, he had not tried a case in court. Even Republican senators called his nomination an embarrassment. And so essentially my story is about how he and Alice LaCour, who is herself a federal prosecutor, who is married to the Alabama Solicitor General, who's also a big-time Federalist Society guy, how they sort of, for legitimate reasons or not, they mask their identities and kind of blend into the world of true crime podcasting, where they were embraced by a lot of people who thought of themselves as liberals, and then were very disappointed when they looked up, you know, these people they had developed these parasocial relationships with, discovered that, you know, among other things, Brett had been writing, you know, defending the first iteration of the Ku Klux Klan as maybe not so bad as the later ones. I mean, he just had this wealth of online comments that came up during his judicial nomination. And I thought it was just fascinating to see how this guy was sort of able to reinvent himself as a true crime podcaster.
Is the true crime crowd, you know, praising you like the king you are, or are they pretty upset about the whole thing?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, there is kind of a thriving community of angry fans of the prosecutors who have since, I mean, I initially found out about this story because we got a tip from someone who had been a fan of this podcast, of the prosecutors podcast, and had sort of turned on them as a result after finding out their identities. You know, I thought it was an interesting story about, you know, first of all, there were a lot of sides, I would say, that these folks were pretty conservative to begin with. Number one, they're prosecutors. Number two, when they opened their podcast, they had a couple rules of like how they would run the podcast and to avoid too much speculation. And one of them was most of the time police are honest and telling the truth. And so there were kind of some hints that that maybe these were not members of the DSA. You know, nevertheless, I talked to a woman who is a sort of retired homemaker in Baltimore who got into true crime listening to these podcasts. As I think people often do, they develop parasocial relationships. You know, they sort of think of these people as your friends or you enjoy the banter between them. She had really come to, you know, to appreciate their takes on these crimes. And then when she discovered this stuff, she felt very betrayed. I mean, the one a lot of these disaffected listeners cite is this one after Sandy Hook, when this Brett guy was like, you know, now more than ever, you need to join the NRA. The NRA is defending all our rights. And she really felt that kind of in her core, very disgusted by that. So, you know, I thought it was an interesting story about the collision between, you know, what people come to, what maybe they project onto podcast hosts that they like, and then that reality kind of being shaken. So, you know, as we come to close this episode, you know, I would just like to say, you know, number one, the Fever Dreams podcast guarantee, I am not a failed Trump judicial nominee in disguise.
You sure will?
We're coming to the end of our guest hosting run here with Zach. So Zach, you know, I just want to thank you for joining us on the pod.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, feel free to follow my work, of course, at The Daily Beast and over on SiriusXM and on Twitter at ZTPetrizza.
Okay.
On that note, let's wrap up this episode of Fever Dreams from The Daily Beast. In future installments, we'll also be speaking to some amazing guests at The Daily Beast and beyond, from politics to popular culture.
We hope you'll subscribe to us on your preferred podcast app and share the show on social media and at your family dinner table. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Will Summer and Kelly is at Kelly Weill. That's W-E-I-L-L. Come say hi. This podcast is produced by Jesse Cannon with music by Brian DiMeglio. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.